Welcome, everyone, to the Transportation Committee meeting. We have our chair is presenting multiple bills today, so it's starting up there. We do not yet have quorum. Is that still correct?
We're going to hope to get you.
All right. Nelson, Representative Nelson just walked in. We do have a quorum. Representative Petersburg, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from the last meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And according to everything that I can see, everything looks good. So I approve the March 5th minutes of Transportation Committee.
Wonderful. Thank you, sir. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passed unanimously. And today we have a packed agenda, so we're going to keep everything moving relatively quickly today. So thank you, everybody, for your participation in that. And we're going to start off with House File 513 with Representative Listengard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as tradition, I am a freshman, and this is the first time that I'm presenting. So I will give treats, and I will give it to the longest-serving legislator in the history of Minnesota.
And, Mr. Chair, I would very proudly move that House File 513 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So we are, House File 513 has been entered. Representative Listengard, would you like to talk about your bill, please?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 513. This legislation is one that is both personal and critical to the City of Virginia and our region. House File 513 fulfills two main objectives. First, it reimburses $5.4 million to the City of Virginia taxpayers for the cost they incurred performing utility work associated with the Highway 53 reroute and the construction of the bridge overlooking the former Richel Mine pit. When the state enacted the funding for the project, it included money for the City of Virginia, but those dollars fell short in covering the cost, leaving the local taxpayers and the City of Virginia stuck with the overruns. Secondly, this bill will honor a former colleague of this body, a champion of the Iron Range, the region he so proudly represented for over 26 years. This bill will honor our friend Tom Rukavina. As with Tommy, there's always a little irony. After all, we will be naming the tallest bridge in the state of Minnesota after a guy that barely eclipsed 5 feet. While naming this magnificent engineering marvel after the Tom Rukavina Memorial Bridge, we will always remember of a man that spent a lifetime fighting for the working class people and those who couldn't fight for themselves. Tom Rukavina was a man of the people and for the people. Tommy was a historian and very proud of the rich history of the Iron Range, and I can't think of a better way to honor him than with this. Now I'm going to turn it over to Chair Hornstein, a co-author and a dear friend of Tom Rukavina.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hornstein. Chair, and thank you, Representative Listengard, for your work and your passion. We talked about this idea very early on, and I'm very, very pleased that you followed through and that you're here today. I was very, very fortunate to have served with Tom Rukavina for 12 of my years here. He was short in stature, but a giant at the legislature. His spirit, his humor, as Representative Listengard said, his deep passion to champion all the causes of the Iron Range are legion. They're legendary here. I miss him dearly. And this is just one small way that this legislature can honor this giant of the legislature. There's not been anyone like him, I think, quite like him before. I can't imagine there'll be anyone like him after. I think both sides of the aisle agree that he was really a very, very special public servant and friend. And I do greatly appreciate Representative Listengard's efforts.
Thank you very much, Chair Hornstein. Are there any discussion points or questions before we lay this one over for possible?
I do have a testifier, if we could speak on behalf.
Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg French. I'm the General Manager of the Virginia Department of Public Utilities. I know you've got a busy schedule today, so I'll keep it as short as I can. It's an honor for me to be up here testifying in a bill that would name Virginia Native and Mr. Tom Roccavino's name dedicated to this bridge. If you look at page 3 of your packet, there's a picture on page 3 that'll tell 1,000 words. The history of this bridge is it was constructed due to the mining efforts by United Taconite, which you can see coming into the picture from the upper right of that photo. You can see the old highway alignment a little bit to the left of that, and then you can see the new bridge crossing over the body of water, the abandoned mine pit. I want to thank the legislature first for providing us bonding money to pay for our infrastructures, which were essential to this construction project, because Virginia does have a midway addition in which we needed to serve sewer and water. But also there's a water line that is hung off of that bridge that serves as an emergency water system between the city of Mountain Iron, city of Virginia, city of Gilbert, city of McKinley, the township of Fail, along with the city of Eveleth. So that piece of infrastructure was very important to get across the bridge. To make a long story short, $6 million of that bonding money that we received was negotiated away. At the time, it was kind of a moving target as to where the highway may be. If you look up towards the mining operation, you can see a ramp. That ramp really was alignment that the mine was setting up for us, which was the location we thought we were going to cross when all was said and done. So with that being said, Mr. Chair, I want to thank this committee. Last year, we had $5.4 million in the omnibus finance bill. That ended up getting vetoed by the governor. And I would like to ask that this committee again work with us in supporting us to have this bill as part of the omnibus transportation finance bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. French. I appreciate you being here and coming a long way to share your story with us. So thank you very much. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this quick. Honored to support the effort to rename the bridge in honor of Representative Roccavino. Of course, we all have a variety of memories of Tom, but they're all entertaining. And he was, as you said, a giant among us. In spite of his stature, I have toured this bridge and seen it from below. And I have to admit that when I looked up to that bridge so high up in the air, I really didn't think about Tom Roccavino, but now I will. And it's quite a structure. It's quite a bridge. And then I will also back up the remarks that were just made a moment ago about the funds for the city of Virginia. You know, there are times around here when our cities get the short shrift, so to speak. A project gets done because of circumstances. Portions of a project don't get properly funded. I think it's absolutely appropriate that the state step back in and that we take the action necessary to make sure that they're made whole. This is an example of that. I was happy to have it in last year's bill. I was disappointed to see it vetoed, and I would be happy to support it again this go-around. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Any further discussion? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. We will lay that over for we need to renew the motion, if you could. I will renew the motion to re-refer the House File 513 for potential possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Future omnibus bill. John, did I say that correctly? I said that correctly. All right. We're good. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Now we are going to the next bill we are going to take up is also Chair Hornstein's, and this is House File 286 that we're going to go with next. Is that correct, Representative Chair Hornstein?
Yep.
Got to keep saying that correctly. Thank you very much. Would you like to introduce your bill?
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 286 is related to railroads. It's a bill that's been around the legislature for a number of years. Mandates a two-person crew for the Class 1 and Class 2 railroads. My interest in carrying this bill, Mr. Chair and members, relates primarily to safety issues. The issue of rail safety came really much to my attention as a result of the disaster in Quebec in 2013, the Lac-Mégantic disaster, and 47 people died in that accident. And I've been working hard to make sure that we prevent those types of accidents from happening again. The reason I bring up that particular incident is that when the Canadian government investigated the causes of that crash and derailment, they cited the issue of inadequately staffed crew of that particular train. And so that's what motivates me to present this bill. I'm very pleased that we have bipartisan authorship of it, and I would defer to Mr. Qualley for his very brief comments in support of the bill, and then I know you have we have a number of testifiers as well.
Thank you very much, Chair Ornstein. Yes, as you are absolutely correct, we do have a large number of testifiers on this bill, and so if everyone can keep your comments to 2 minutes, I'd appreciate it, and I am unfortunately nowhere near as nice of a person as Chair Hornstein is, so I have no problem keeping things, keeping it going, so if you can all keep it to 2 minutes, I would greatly appreciate it. So, Mr. Qualley, if you could please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Philip Qualley, State Director for the United Transportation Union, Smart Transportation Division, and I will be as quick as I possibly can. You all have a handout in your packet. I would hope that you take a look at it. There's ample statistics, photographs, and information. Today we have testifier Mr. Brian Hunstead, as well as our designated legal counsel, Mr. Hunnigs and Courtney Leneve with Hunnigs and Leneve Kvass. Today we respectfully request the House to support House File 286 that requires two persons on all Class 1 and 2 freight trains in Minnesota. Currently we have two persons on all trains. I will walk through the bill language very quickly. It just it is a prohibition of Class 1 and Class 2 railroads, which essentially exempts the Class 3 railroads, the Minnesota Short Line Association railroads. This section also, it has exemption of hostler helpers, remote control locomotives and yards, and also as provided for in 218 of the 49 CFR code, which gives all of the flexibility to the railroads to continue where we have one-person operations out in yard operations. Because my time is limited, I want to just quickly address some of the concerns and feedback that I have heard, and I respect the legislature, regarding the concern for collective bargaining and getting involved in the private industry. Number one, these are mass tonnage machines going across the countryside, and you have a duty to protect the public. And if I may read, and I will then close, House File 286 only calls for two individuals on all trains. It has nothing to do with agreements. Railroad carriers have a legal obligation to their shareholders. Unions have a legal obligation to protect the safety and interests of their membership. Neither party has a specific obligation to the public. The state has an obligation to protect public safety. And I guess I will have to cut off here earlier than the entire collective bargaining statement we wanted to make, that very quickly, the collective bargaining cannot be a substitute for safety laws or regulations. It is the state's responsibility to protect the public life and property. And additionally, the Minnesota legislature cannot defer your obligation to protect the public. So I will close by saying this is not preempted. This is not an undue burden on commerce. I want to thank you very much for hearing, and I hope that you'll take a look at our packet as well as letters of support from other stakeholder groups. And really, folks, respectfully, this is about protecting the public and the fundamental Samaritan response after we hit somebody at a grade crossing. And the last question I'll pose, thank you, Mr. Chairman, after we hit somebody at a grade crossing, and again, there's been 40, on average, 40 grade crossings in Minnesota per year. are we going to leave people in the ditches of Minnesota unattended? And having two persons on a train, as we do now, assures the Samaritan response to the public. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Do we have any questions for Mr. Qualley? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Chair. Is there documentation? I know you brought this forward here, but don't have time to read it right now in front of the hearing right now. But is there documentation that having two-person cab makes it safer with the new technologies that are afforded? Is there studies and stuff that have done that? And, you know, my understanding in Canada and Europe, they don't necessarily have two-person.
First of all, the railroads control all the data. And so any studies from Europe, New Zealand, Australia are significantly different. I would argue that the data is actually in the record profits the railroads are earning, the record low operating ratios, and the safety records that they currently are extolling to the public. I hope that answers your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it kind of does. The answer was doesn't appear that there's any particular study, but I appreciate Mr. Qualley's opinion. Thank you.
May I, Mr. Chairman, very quickly, I would have given the entire committee a copy of our letter of May 5th addressed to the Federal Railroad Administration Chief Director Ronald Batory regarding his request for comments as to autonomous operation of trains. And I think you have a copy of that, Representative, and I hope you take a look at that letter of May 5th, 2018. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to that question, the letter in your packet from the League of Minnesota Cities, I think, is helpful because these are local leaders who experience on a local level. And what they say in their letter, safety concerns about freight trains have become more pronounced for city leaders and residents as the number and length of trains have increased due to frac sand and crude oil entering the state by rail to and from North Dakota. On the local level, when leaders in the League of Minnesota Cities see the actual activity in their city, they become convinced that this kind of staffing level, just given the increased risks, becomes necessary. That's sort of those with personal experience.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, that is correct. And it's a fundamental question to our towns and cities and our citizens. Are we going to be able to uncouple crossings and open up crossings so that emergency responders, public thoroughfare, and commerce can open and standing trains are not blocking crossings? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being here. And we're going to move on to the next testifier, which is Mr. Brian. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative O'Driscoll. I did not see you over there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very brief question for the testifier. In the findings on the accident that occurred, which is very tragic, as was mentioned earlier, in the 18 findings of the deficiencies, were any of those cited that it was a deficiency because there wasn't two person, as you are advocating for today in the legislation as before the committee? Was that a deficiency that was cited by the Canadian STB? Transportation Safety Board.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, I assume you're referring to the Canadian Transportation Board study, the LAC Megantic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there were multiple factors, a safety process system failures, failure of support, and yes, absolutely. With one person on a freight train, we cannot, and the LAC Megantic train did not, properly secure the train mechanically from rolling away. Amongst mechanical defects on the locomotive, a identified weak safety system reporting with the short line railroad, and to answer your question, yes, one-person crews, it is virtually impossible to secure your train to keep it from rolling away mechanically and with the pneumatic air brakes.
Got it. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I asked was, did the study point out that there were deficiencies because of the two? You've suggested that you would like to have two on there, and I think that was maybe your opinion on the topic. I'm just asking, did the study or did the TESB's report cite that one of the deficiencies was? You indicated that, one person can't do it. I tend to agree that that may be a question or an issue that needs to be discussed. I'm just asking, did they cite in that report that a two-person crew is the reason why, or a lack of a two-person crew is the reason why the disaster was as catastrophic as it was. I don't mean to be argumentative. I think you shared your thought on that and opinion. I'm just asking if the report had that, because I looked at it and I didn't see it. I might be missing something else that wasn't in the report or might have overlooked that. So,
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, we have a copy of the Canadian Transportation Board in the office. I can provide you a copy of that. We provided it to other legislators, but I believe the way it was characterized in the study was failure of train securement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Runbeck, you have the final question for Mr. Qualley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Qualley, as you describe the situation, and I've heard this bill now, I think, four times, but you describe leaving people in the ditch. And I guess my question is, are you suggesting that one of the two operators of the train would go down and apply first aid to the victims? I mean, is this the role you see playing? Because that's kind of what is suggested.
Mr. Qualley.
By your comments.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck, thank you very much for your question. We've never had this bill heard in the House before, but yes, you are absolutely right. When we hit a person at a grade crossing accident, I've been in seven of them, the engineer hits the emergency brakes immediately. The engineer has to stay, someone has to stay with the locomotive air brake system as well as the main radio base, which is a stronger transmitter. The vast majority of our conductors and train persons will grab what we have in the engine, first aid kit, paper towels, whatever we have in water, and as soon as the train is decelerated to a point where we can drop off, the vast majority of our train crews go running back to help those people. That is a Samaritan response. It's a humanitarian response. We will apply pressure points to the bleeding. I've done it myself. And then when the EMTs show up, the emergency responders, after we've made the emergency call, they need us there with a radio to the main radio, and we're assisting them handing off the bleeding pressure point and then helping them extract. We cannot expect the emergency responders to get on, under, or about the equipment without us there immediately. And then finally, I just have to say, as much as I respect the railroad colleagues here today, the railroads will never tell you this, but this is what goes on across the ditches of Minnesota, and we cannot leave Minnesotans unattended in the ditches of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Representative Runbeck.
To follow up, Mr. Chair, sir, engineers are all EMTs trained and ready to do this? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Qualley.
Are the operators EMTs and fully trained?
No, the railroads do not give us first aid training. We would welcome that. It would be a friendly amendment. But the bottom line here is that we do the best we can, and we see the incident, and we have a responsibility as humans to go down and help the people out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. We're going to move on now to Dave Brown, will be the next testifier. And after Mr. Brown is Brian Hunstead.
Good afternoon, Chairman. My name is David Brown. I'm with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers as the state legislative chairman for Minnesota, as well as the National Region 3 legislative chairman. For over 156 years, our organization has been serving the front lines of this industry.
Mr. Brown, can you get close to the microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yep, thank you.
For over 150 years, our organization has been very influential and in process for the front lines of this industry that's dedicated to safety, our safety, the public safety, and protecting the environment. With 48 years working on the railroad, and now working as a locomotive engineer on the North Star, we are voluntarily trained in CPR and first aid training. The BNSS have had that program for quite a while, that they offer that first aid training, which is very important not only for us, but for people that are hit in crossing incidents. I'd like to touch base on railroad technology. It's evolving. It's very much evolving, but not the reliability, the dependability, due to the nature of all the variables and catastrophic failures of technology. In contrast, two persons on every locomotive and train is 100% reliable and dependable to skillfully and professionally respond immediately to any and all situations. Moving on to PTC, I operate PTC 100% on the North Star. This notion that PTC is justification for reducing the training crew size. The implementation of PTC is a pretext to reducing train crew size, and it is unfounded as it doesn't respond at any crossing, accidents, derailments, or mechanical issues with the train. PTC is simply another safety overlay of operating systems using radio, global positioning, Wi-Fi, cell tower, and digital technology. Have anybody here ever had a cell phone go down or your Wi-Fi go down in your house? These are not technology that is 100% reliable. But they are a benefit. They have their benefit. They do not replace another person on a crew. We are first responders by the very nature of our job. We're first responders to derailments, accidents, and many mechanical issues. When an incident occurs, that second person is on the ground and walking back to find the problem or the injured or that leaking hazmat car. Most operating employees are offered, as I said, and attend CPR and first aid basic training. As me as an engineer, by law and rule, I had to remain at the locomotive to man that radio to direct first responders through the immediate on-site, on-the-ground actions and communications of that second crew member. I'd like to touch base on a report that was done by Oliver Wyman. And I will, it's all in my packet that I gave you, the testimony of the various points, and there's even more that they justify saying that because of foreign railroads, that they have this one-person crew idea that is very safe. Well, item one, in Europe, they mix freight and passenger service together. There is no freight trains, per se, in Europe. They are run together. They are mostly between 1,600 and 2,700 feet. We run and operate trains that weigh over 20,000 tons and up to 3 miles long. I'd like to state another thing that was said about the Railroad Safety Advisory Committee. That was disbanded. They were reorganized. They were a much smaller group. And this the crew staffing, which I was on, the RSAC, has been thrown out by the Office of Management. There's no other there in the notice of proposed rulemaking by the FRA.
All right. Are you close, Mr. Brown?
Yes, I could go on, but I know it's 2 minutes there.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Brown? All right. Thank you very much. Did you have any closing comments you wanted to say after I interrupted you there?
Well, in closing, the Association of American Railroads' own assertion, not enough operational data exists regarding the safety of a single-person crew. That speaks volumes to the interest and lack of, or their lack of, for the public safety. The only way to gather personal crew data in this country is for the train crews and the public to assume the risk that is being offloaded by the Class 1, Class 2s.
Thank you very
much. And I hope that you support House File 286, and I think it's one of the most important safety items for the public.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Next up, we have Mr. Brian Hunstad and then Courtney Leneve.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Brian Hunstad. I'm 62 years old and a 26-year veteran of the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. In that capacity, I've been a trainman, brakeman, and conductor, and I work over the road. I ask you to support two persons on all trains in Minnesota for the reason public needs legislative intervention to assure safety out on the prairies. Over the past several years, train crews across Minnesota are being instructed by train dispatchers to block public crossing at grade. We do not want to block crossings, but it's inherently unsafe to block public crossings. When our crews are instructed to do so, we have to fulfill the dispatcher's instructions or face charges of insubordination and dismissal of service. So we're put in an untenable situation. At crossings, when we stop, we get off, have the engineers pull ahead, make crossing cuts so that public can be moved through, emergency vehicles can get to where they need to go, and we also do mechanical inspections. We do roll-bys of other trains to check for defects, shifted loads, leaking hazardous material, and so forth. When we hit somebody at a crossing, and I've been there like Phil has, the first guy on the ground, I'm at the vehicle. Pulling somebody out of a burning vehicle, applying pressure, doing CPR, and again, I'm a BNSF employee. Yes, we do get safety training. I take that very seriously. Public safety is number one. If there's one person on a train, there's no way we're going to be able to open up crossings. The engineer, Dave and Philip, both said they have to stay on the engine, they have to secure an engine. One person can't do that. Our 400 crew members on BNSF in western Minnesota are very concerned that unless the state acts as soon as possible to assure two persons on all trains, you'll never keep your grade crossings open. Emergency response, business trucks, people going home, all will be delayed. There'll be nothing you can do in the state law. So our job is to ensure that trains move safely, and you as legislators have a wonderful opportunity to do something great for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Let's get on board and get this thing done. Let's pass this legislation for the safety of Minnesota. I finally want to thank Representative Baker, Dean Erdahl, and Representative Kyle, and others who have co-authored this bill. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Honstad.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe this has been stated. How many states mandate a two-person crew?
I believe there's 14 or 15. California is one.
Wally.
I'm sorry, Madam, Mr. Chairman and Representative Runbeck, could you please restate your question?
Right, sure. Thank you. How many states, Mr. Qualley, mandate the two-person crew that you're proposing?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry. At this time, the states of Arizona, California, and Wisconsin have minimum train crew requirements. California most recently has not been federally preempted. It has not been challenged in court. It's federally preempted. Currently, over 20 states are moving minimum train crew requirement. Most recently, in Colorado, it has moved in two houses to the governor's desk. Wyoming, it has moved through one chamber. In Maryland last year, it moved through two chambers. The states do have the right to regulate to protect the citizens. This is not a federally preempted issue. Thank you.
Representative Runbeck, any follow-up?
That's fine.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Thank you, Mr. Hunstead. Now we have Courtney Leneve.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Courtney Leneve. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and have been practicing law for over 30 years, representing individuals from the state of Minnesota and railroad workers in the state of Minnesota and elsewhere. Our firm was involved in the Minot derailment litigation, where thousands of people in the state of North Dakota were injured when a train derailed just outside of Minot. The conductor in that case got off of the engine. The engineer stayed on the engine, and he went back and he separated his train to get him and the engineer to a place of safety where they could warn the community of Minot of the approaching hazardous cloud that was coming. That's just one example where thousands of people would have otherwise been on the road that morning and engulfed in a significant anhydrous ammonia cloud. We have narrowly avoided a catastrophe here, and I would say we do so more often than any of us would know and more often than the railroads will ever tell us. When a few years back, a train, it happened to be a corn train, derailed in Rice Creek near the Mississippi River, okay? And I represented the conductor on that particular catastrophe as well. Had that been a hazmat train, the Mississippi River, which was only a short distance away, would have been filled with hazmat. So what do the men and women do that are on those trains that we need two people? Even if we had positive train control, we had GPS, which we don't have today and is not operational on a full level across the state of Minnesota or across this nation. We don't have trains from CP. We have lots of different trains going around. What would we do if the railroad had one person, and that person is now in the river, and the conductor isn't available to call for help? What do we do when someone has a heart attack or a stroke on a train? And those things happen as well. So we respond to those things in our practice and deal with those. So I am pushing for a person, for as a member of the public and a person who represents railroad workers, for this committee and our legislature to mandate two-man crews. The railroad would love nothing better than to cut their costs in half and have one person running a train, putting us all at substantial risk of serious injury and or problems for massive numbers of people in our community, not just crossing victims, which oftentimes can be a car of one to five or not that that's not significant, but I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of people in our communities that can be at risk. It is critically important that this bill get passed sooner than later, before we're dealing with more serious problems. As it relates to the issue of technology, and I'll just address that quickly. The railroads, there and studies about technology, the railroads know how important two-man crews are. They spent the time and money to put horns and emergency brakes on the conductor side of the locomotives. That speaks volume to what they know is happening on the other side, and that is people are working in a fatigued state, oftentimes called without adequate sleep, afraid to report that they don't have adequate sleep, and so we have the technology in place that the railroads recognize is needed for public safety. So now you eliminate that person. As it relates to preemption, I can assure you that preemption was addressed in the Minot litigation. State safety and the safety of our citizens, we have the right to regulate and take action as a legislative body to protect our citizens, and I don't think the courts are going to have an issue, particularly with the new Supreme Court.
Thank you, Mr. Leeney. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next testifier we have is, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair. Just as the author, I want to take a little prerogative with the testifiers. My understanding is that we have a couple people from out of town from BNSF, and I would want to make sure that they can get their testimony in, and there would be opportunity for the committee to question them if necessary. So I don't know on the list where they are, but I'd...
We have Mr. Apitz is next, and then two folks from BNSF are the followers of that. Is that the Mr. Apitz? Is that the way you'd like to proceed, or Mr. Chair, are you okay with that? Mr. Chair, does that work for you? Or
that's great. No, okay. Just want to make sure they get in.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Apitz.
Very kind of you. My name is John Apitz. I'm law firm of Missley and Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, which is opposed to House File 286. And it's a bill that mandates two-person crews on all freight trains, Class 1 and Class 2 freight trains operating in Minnesota. I'm going to give you just a quick overview and then allow others, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, the chance to provide a little more detail. Well, the stated aim of this bill sounds quite laudable. In actual fact, it undercuts rail collective labor bargaining. It ignores regular improvements being made in rail safety. It interferes with federal regulatory responsibilities, and it creates a competitive disadvantage, possibly a competitive disadvantage, for shippers in Minnesota. So first, crew size is fundamentally a collective bargaining issue. Railroad collective bargaining falls under the Railway Labor Act, which is overseen by the Congress and the President of the United States. Rail collective bargaining is nearly a century old, and it has produced improvements that have placed railroads in the forefront of transportation safety innovations, and it's resulted in agreements that have placed railroad employees above 93% of all U.S. workers with regard to pay and total compensation. The Minnesota legislature should not interfere with collective bargaining. Sam Marciadano is here from Burlington Northern Santa Fe. He's with the labor relations arm of BNSF, and he'll offer you an idea of how collective bargaining works and why it's important. Secondly, railroads are safe, and they are getting safer. Over the past two decades, railroads have deployed new technology and operating practices that have resulted in record safety numbers. For instance, positive train control that you heard about just a little bit earlier is a federally mandated technology designed to stop trains before accidents happen. It's in place today along with a lot of other safety measures, allowing railroads to continue to negotiate and innovate rather than mandating a particular operating practice is the best way to assure safety along the lines. Lydia Bjorge is the State Director of Government Relations, and she'll give you greater detail on some of the safety measures that are in place. Third, single-person crews aren't novel, and they're not something that's untested. You heard earlier, passenger trains, short-line railroads, in-yard operations, and many freight railroads use single-person crews today and have been doing so for decades. Our safety regulator, the Federal Railroad Administration, has acknowledged that it cannot provide reliable or conclusive statistical data to suggest whether one-person crew operations are generally safer or less safe than multiple crew operations. And it's kind of ironic that this legislature would be considering the question of how we can put driverless vehicles on our public roadways while at the same time considering legislation that would mandate the size of crews and locomotives operating on private dedicated railways. Finally, Rod Dewar, who is Vice President and the Chief Safety Officer for Union Pacific Railroad, can give you a better idea of some of the safety measures in place. And this is preempted. This is the oversight of the Federal Railroad Administration specifically is what preempts this. And Michael LeBaron is here from Chicago law firm of Fletcher Sipple to speak to that particular case. There are a couple of others, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Mining, who are here as well. If they have an opportunity to speak, they'd appreciate doing so. But if I may, would ask Mr. Marciadano to come up and speak with you.
First, I'm going to see if there are any questions for you, Mr. Appitz. Does anyone have questions for... All right, seeing none, thank you very much.
Hi, how are you?
Please state your name for the committee.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Sam Macedonio. I'm the Assistant Vice President of Labor Relations for BNSF Railroad. I've been in the position of bargaining and administrating contracts for over 20 years. I've worked on both the passenger side and freight side during my career, and I currently am responsible for that position at BNSF. I wanted to take my 2 minutes just to talk a little bit about collective bargaining and the railroads. We've been engaged in collective bargaining since 1927 when the Railway Labor Act was enacted. Over the last 40 years, we've really concentrated both management and labor about minimum manning. And that's what this bill is really all about. It's not a safety bill. It's about minimum manning. It's about mandating how many people are on a train. We started most impactfully back in the 80s where we had technology that replaced cabooses, and that eliminated some people. You remember steam engines before that? When we got rid of steam engines, that eliminated the need for some people, and we collectively bargained them with our union partners out of the contract and compensated them for that. Fast forward till 1993, where we sat down with each of our labor partners and negotiated two-man crews, and that's what we have currently today. Since 1993, we have not bargained crew size, but it is ripe at some point in time as technology does improve. It may be a topic of collective bargaining, and we will sit across the table with our union partners and talk about that and talk about how we do it. You've heard a lot about safety here today, and I can say that every conversation at BNSF and most railroads starts with safety and ends with safety. We wouldn't do anything that is not safe. Additionally, you heard a lot about crossings. We would negotiate with our union partners on how to use our people to do this more efficiently. We would not leave our trains strung out across the railroad. We would not leave people of the communities in danger. And we would negotiate a way to use our people to help do that and put them on the ground to make us more efficient, not less efficient, make us more safe, not less safe. We have continued to do that over time. We sit and we talk about fatigue, and we negotiate schedules with employees. We offer things to reduce fatigue, not increase it. We offer safety committees to increase safety, not reduce it. We talked about predictive schedules, and many other things have been bargained over our 100-year history almost with our labor unions, and we will continue to do the same. We would ask respectfully that you do not progress this bill, 286, and allow us as the railroads to sit across from our partners as we've done for the last 40 years and talk about minimum manning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Macedonio. Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No question, but an observation that I find there's a little bit of humor in this. That we're told that this bill undercuts rail collective bargaining when, in fact, the defenders of it are the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen and the Rail Union. And I suppose the testifiers are suggesting they somehow haven't figured out collective bargaining in all this time. Just a little bit of humor.
Thank you. Mr. Macedonio, any?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I mean, you know, we may find some humor in that as well, but we have sat across the table, and we'll continue to sit across the table and bargain that.
All right. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, too. So we had a handout, and I think it was under the testimony of David Brown here, in which it talked about the amount of collisions that have occurred over the years and so forth. And looks like in the last 30 years, they've gone down to only about a third of what they were. Do we know how many are of these fatalities and collisions actually occur in Minnesota?
I do not know that information, but I do not know that information, but Mr. Rod Dorr, the Vice President of Safety for UP, is here. He may be able to enlighten us on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully we get that information. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Qualley or Mr. Brown, did you have anything to add for that since you were referenced?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, this legislation only calls for two individuals. By making a claim that Minnesota's public safety is best represented through a private collective bargaining, the railroad's carriers seek to place labor in the untenable situation of negotiating away public safety for personal monetary gain, which it is under no obligation to do. We cannot strike a carrier over safety issues that impacts public safety. If the public safety was deferred to a collective bargaining agreement and the railroad carrier violates that interest, operates in a negligent manner that affects the public, or destroys physical evidence after an incident involving the public, there is no enforcement mechanism to protect the public's interest if the safety provisions are solely in a collective bargaining agreement. The state of Minnesota has a responsibility to protect public safety. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Bernardi.
Yeah, I think it's starting to get brought up here now, so maybe I don't have to say it, but I just find it really troubling that it's that the railroads use this as a collective bargaining issue. I live in the community in which the train derailed. And even though we were fortunate it was corn, but it left a huge mess in our community with very little oversight and accountability for the cleanup and making the community whole. And I just, I thank our conductors and engineers for bringing this bill forward and helping raise the issue and helping our state to take responsibility and take it off of collective bargaining. And it's not really funny, but and I don't think this is funny, but some people may think it's funny or not necessary to say. But I hear this is crew size, and I appreciate that as a woman. I've heard the word man used, and I don't know if you – maybe there's not a lot of women, but when you use the language that's been used about men in that testimony, I don't think it's not really helpful in talking about this. And you might not think it's very serious, but to me it's offensive. Thank you.
Mr. Mastrona.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think the words I used were minimum manning provision, and that's just a term of art, and I apologize for that. This is about crew size, and like I said, we have negotiated this. We had 5 to 7 people at one point in time, and now we're down to 2 people. We do use 3 and 4 where it's, you know, we believe it's more efficient and safe. And we're not here seeking an act to go down to 1 person or even to 0 people. We're merely here to ask that you leave this up to the parties to continue bargaining as they've done for the last 40 years, and try to persuade you that us as a railroad will do nothing that is unsafe. I mean, removing someone from the cab, if we were to agree with that, we would then have to go to the FRA to submit our plan, which was the federal regulation body that governs us, to make sure we are safe and we do act safe, and they would have to approve our plan that we actually are going to do this safely. So, and we believe that we could redistribute some of the manpower to actually make our railroads safer, and I apologize, our crew members or people, definitely wouldn't be crew, it would be other employees, that we could move to make ourselves more efficient and safer for you and your communities.
Thank you. We're going to move on. We're starting to run out of time here, so we're going to move on to Ms. Bjorgi from BNSF as well, and then Mr. Durr from Union Pacific.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lydia Bjorgi. I'm Executive Director of State Government Affairs for BNSF. We strongly oppose House File 286. You've heard a little bit about technology and data. That's what I'll talk about today. The railroad does have technology to address the single largest cause for track derailments, which we've heard a little bit about derailments across the country, which is human error. We have a technology that will stop the train, positive train control. Positive train control is advanced technology designed to automatically stop a train before certain incidents caused by human error can occur. Incidents like collisions, derailments, or work zone mishaps. Through GPS, Wi-Fi, and radio transmissions, computers, locomotives, and rail operation centers across the country are linked. Across the national network, critical information is continually relayed. Speed limits, train movement authorizations, switch positions, location of work zones, and other key operational data is shared. The engineer still controls the train, but positive train control acts as a safeguard to prevent speed and train movement violations. The system provides an onboard warning, so it lets the engineer know that they're entering a potential violation, and should the engineer not respond before reaching the braking zone, positive train control is designed automatically and will always stop the train. It prevents things like train-to-train collisions, derailments caused by excessive speed, unauthorized intrusions into sections of track where maintenance activities are taking place, movement of a train through a misaligned switch. And I talk about this technology because these safety results that you heard about today are record safety years we're having on the railroad. And the increase in technology to even further enhance safety is exactly why this is the wrong time to mandate crew size standards. You heard stories of accidents in the testimony. However, the data and regulators tell a different story. President Obama's Administration Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs stated, quote, Federal Railroad Administration does not have information that suggests that there have been any previous accidents involving one-person crew operations that could have been avoided by adding a second crew member. Because it was brought up, I'll also address Loch Megantic incident you heard about today. Canadians Transportation Safety Board exhaustively investigated the incident and found 18 factors that contributed to that horrible tragedy. Not one of those factors includes or even points to the fact that an additional person would have made a difference. In fact, the Canadian Transportation Safety Board found, quote, it could not conclude that the use of a one-person crew was a cause or contributing factor to the accident. Railroads have and will continue to see record safety years in large part due to the technology and innovation that's making us safer and more efficient. No data supports the idea that two-person crews are safer than one-person crews. We're not here asking for one-person crews. We're here asking that you allow us to work with our union partners at the bargaining table, not at the state legislature, to agree with our union partners on crew size. An agreement that would be reached only after the unions and railroads agree and believe it's safe and the unions vote to ratify the agreement. A state mandate impedes on the bargaining process, is not supported by facts and data, and is federally preempt.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bjorgi. Any questions? All right, seeing none, thank you. We're going to move on to Mr. Dewar from Union Pacific, and then Michael Barron from Fletcher Sipple.
Good afternoon. My name is Rod Dorr. I'm Vice President, Chief Safety Officer for Union Pacific Railroad. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about safety. Safety is Union Pacific's number one priority. As a company, we continuously look for innovative approaches to enhance safety of our employees, communities, and the customers we serve. We invest significant resources in training, research development, and public education, all with the goal to increase rail safety awareness and improve safety. Please allow me to address the types of incidents that have been described here by earlier folks that have testified. Should there be a crossing incident or circumstances where a pedestrian is struck on the tracks, the engineer would call for help via the radio to the dispatcher. For our railroad, that's our dispatcher is in Omaha, Nebraska. In turn, the dispatcher would immediately call emergency services. Let's say the train was going 55 miles an hour. It will take more than a mile to stop. It is very likely the railroad's dispatch will be able to get an emergency responder to the nearby or a nearby rail worker to the scene much sooner than it would take the conductor to walk back that mile. And given the weather and snow that we've recently experienced, this walk may take much longer than that 40 minutes. Conductors have no special training. They are not required to be CPR certified. They absolutely can calm and provide comfort to those that are injured, but it's more likely that emergency responders will beat them there. And they will have the right training and most assuredly the life-saving equipment to assist. Next, if there is a blocked crossing during emergency, railroad dispatch, not the crew, is in constant communication with local authorities and can guide them to the best route to either intercept the train or to go around the train, often without having to cut the train. The crew is not necessarily always asked to cut the train in emergencies. If a determination is made to cut the train, the crew will work with dispatch, other railroad personnel, and emergency responders. On occasion, the crew will be asked to cut the train, but usually only after others arrive. Again, that walk we discussed is pertinent, meaning the second crew person is not necessarily the first to act. In the event of a block crossing, any number of personnel may be available to break the train. In many cases, a roving conductor, or maybe one of our mechanical employees in a mechanic's truck, or a railroad manager in an emergency may be more practical and time effective to cut that train. I would like to also address if there's a medical emergency inside the cab of our locomotive. If there is an emergency, there is a device called an alerter. That alerter is a button that the engineer presses every few seconds based on the speed of the train. If that button is not pressed, in other words, the engineer has some type of medical event, then they're incapacitated, the train is designed to stop. An immediate signal, an alarm, is set off in our dispatch center, and again, emergency response is dispatched. We have GPS on all of our through freight locomotives, and we know precisely where that locomotive is stopped. To wrap up, safety and technology improvements have been the primary catalyst for negotiations related to crew safety. As a result of these improvements, rail labor and rail management have agreed to reductions in crew size. As many as five persons in the 1970s to our current two-person staffing today. Union Pacific, now 156 years old, can show no correlation exists between crew size and safety improvement.
Thank you, Mr. Dorr.
I would be more than happy to entertain questions.
Any questions for Mr. Dorr? Representative Cosman.
Thank you. And just a quick question. I think I know the answer, but there was a little bit of talk about preemption, which, to my understanding, if you could speak to it real briefly, but I'm guessing that perhaps this bill is kind of not going to withstand, is, I guess, my point. So I'm not sure what your thoughts are on that.
We believe as an industry this is federally preempted. That said, I'm not an attorney. The next testifier is and can answer that question better.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dewar. We'll bring up Mr. Barron next from Fletcher Sipple, followed by Mr. Bentley Graves from Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then could we hold on just a second? Mr. Chair Hornstein, how would you like, we've still got one more bill that we need to hear. How would you like to proceed? And we've
Mr.
still got
Chair,
four testifiers, including yeah, Mr.
Yeah.
Barron.
Mr. Five. Chair, I want to make sure that, so we have several bills, including this one, that need to go to public safety. This needs to go to public safety because it has a fine in it. As does Representative Cagle's bill. And so it would be my preference to make sure that both of those bills get done today. However, I think it's unrealistic that we will be able to get Representative Cagle's bill in now because it does, you know, it's a pretty involved bill and we have a couple of amendments. So I would propose that we come back after session to do just that one bill, that Representative Cagle's bill, just that one. I don't think we'll be able to do the rest of the other rail bills today. Those don't have the same time constraint. So if it's okay with the chair, I would propose that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, did you want to add or no?
thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, you have to do what you have to do. It's your committee. Of course, we're not real anxious to come back, but since we are having another field trip tomorrow, most of us are staying around anyway, so it's not as the hardship it might be on another Thursday.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right. Proceed, Mr. Barron.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Michael Barron. I've been practicing railroad law for 21 years, both as in-house counsel and in private practice. Currently, I'm a member and a partner of the law firm of Fletcher & Sipple in Chicago, and I have spent the better part of two decades working on preemption issues, both for Class 1s and short lines. And I'm here today to talk about federal preemption. Legislation that requires Class 1 and Class 2 railroads to operate with minimum crew sizes would be preempted by federal law, including the Federal Railroad Safety Act, federal labor law, and the Interstate Commerce Act. Under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, federal law overrides or preempts state law. Preemption can either be express, when a federal law provides it should be exclusive, or implied, when a state law conflicts with a federal statute or a federal law suggested by Congress completely occupies a particular field. The Federal Railroad Safety Act contains an express preemption provision that states, laws, regulations, and orders related to railroad safety and law, regulations, and orders related to railroad security shall be nationally uniform to the extent practicable, end quote. It also provides that, quote, a state may adopt or continue to enforce a law, regulation, or order related to railroad safety until the Secretary of Transportation prescribes a regulation or issues an order covering the subject matter of the state requirement, end quote. The FRA has taken substantial action on the issue of crew size, thereby preempting any state law on this subject in any operational context. Specifically, the FRA has issued a safety advisory requiring railroads to review crew staffing. It has declined to impose requirements for over-the-road operations and has issued extensive regulations governing remote control operations that especially contemplate crew size. Recently, the FRA considered a notice of proposed rulemaking on the subject of crew size. After consideration and public input, the FRA suspended this rulemaking and has taken no further action to impose crew size standards. Likewise, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act exists because Congress has determined that the rail industry depends upon a federal regulatory scheme that needs to be uniform because of its intrinsically interstate nature. Allowing states...
Got it. Wrap up here for me.
Okay. The premise of the bill is flawed. There is no room for Minnesota to take action on crew size. The federal government completely occupies the space through a number of federal acts and several actions in recent years by the FRA. And are there any questions?
Thank you. Representative Housen.
Just calling members' attention on the handout that's the SMART handout. The second to the last page has the nation's map where two-person crew state legislation, some places where it's already law or regulation, another place where it's been passed, committee hearing schedules, bills introduced. So I would suggest that this is legislation that is not at all out of keeping with what a state might appropriately deal with, but it might be a helpful map relative to a question asked earlier by Representative Runbeck. Looks like this.
Mr. Beck. Mr. Chair, thank you. We're aware of Wisconsin, which has gone through litigation and which part of their statute was preempted. We're not aware that California has been enforced. Arizona was overturned due to what was called anti-feather bedding laws and case law. As a matter of fact, they've introduced a new bill in Arizona, realizing that the previous Arizona bill would not be enforceable. West Virginia, I believe, has a crew law, too, but that's tied to other states around it adopting crew law, so apparently it's not enforced. That's what I'm aware of with regard to crew size laws in the country.
Thank you, Mr. Barron.
Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barron, you read through that federal statute really quickly. Did we have it in our packets at all?
The Federal Railroad, I mean, which one? The 49 U.S. Code 20106?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barron, the one that explicitly states to the extent practical, that states still do have rights?
I don't know if it's in a packet, but I know the statute by heart, 49 U.S. Code 20106.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, our next testifier is Mr. Bentley Graves from Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Bentley Graves from Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll keep this very brief. I want to draw attention to a letter from the Chamber in your packets, as well as a similar letter outlining similar concerns with this legislation from several associations representing agricultural interests in Minnesota. To put it briefly, we have concerns about the extent to which this legislation would lock in place today's standards, agreements, practices technology around crew size issues and would hamper going forward efforts to harness innovation and efficiencies to realize and accrue benefits to those that that ship and in out of Minnesota and regionally and nationally. And so I'll leave with that and again draw your attention to the letters, but I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you for your brevity. Now we have Kelsey Johnson from the Iron Mining Association. Kelsey Johnson?
Yes, she's there.
Oh, got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm just going to quickly go through the iron mining industry just so I'm kidding. I just want to introduce myself. I'm Kelsey Johnson, president of the Iron Mining Association. Our association represents the 6 taconite facilities and the 2 idled pig iron facilities in northeastern Minnesota. The iron mines directly employ about 4,500 people, and the vendor member community that supports these facilities employ another 11,500 hardworking men and women. The IMA is in opposition to this particular piece of legislation because of the way that the iron mining industry came about. Over 130 years ago, the iron mines in northeastern Minnesota started producing taconite and iron and shipping it to sources throughout the United States and the globe. And at that time, there were no cars, there were no trucks, there were no roads to speak of, so they actually built their own railroad systems. In the downturn in the economies over the course of time, they've offloaded many of those, and we are now captive. And so that means that we have to work with our rail partners very closely. And so this, we feel, would probably drive up our costs. You can see the rest of our arguments on our letter that we submitted to the committee, and I will leave it at that, and I will stand for questions if anybody has them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Seeing none, thank you for being here. Next, we have Steve Supan from Institute of Ag, and final testifier that is scheduled is Claire Rubeck from the Citizens Acting for Rail Safety.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I've submitted written testimony, so I'm going to try to keep this fairly short. I'm speaking in support of 286, but doing so...
Could you please say your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Steve Supan. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy.
Thank you.
Headquartered in Minneapolis. So I'm speaking in support of 286, but... realizing that trains that cross through Minnesota often originate in Canada, especially those that are hauling crude oil or bituminum, diluted bituminum from Alberta, I would like to talk about the impact of the Regulatory Cooperation Council and the Trump administration's broad deregulatory agenda for rail safety. The Regulatory Cooperation Council of the United States and Canada has had a railway safety working group since its inception in 2011. The U.S. request for comment about the RCC states that regulatory cooperation initiatives may, quote, serve deregulatory functions and help agencies achieve the objectives of Executive Order 13771, which is to require that 2 regulations are repealed for everyone that is issued, regardless of the need for those regulations and entirely based on regulatory costs to industry. An example of this kind of approach to regulation is the U.S. Department of Transportation's Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration rescission of a mandate on installing electronically controlled pneumatic brakes based on cost-benefit calculations, according to which, quote, the expected cost of requiring ECP brakes would be significantly higher than the expected benefits of the requirement, unquote. The Associated Press found that the Trump administration underestimated the benefits of deploying these brakes by admitting up to $117 million in estimated future damages from train derailments that could be avoided by using ECP brakes. I'm just going to give a quick list here of some of the deregulatory measures taken by the Trump administration. Measures to require more than to stop regulations to require more than one crew member on dangerous goods transporting systems, measures to delay the employment of positive train control, measures to prohibit a rule requiring certain items carrying high-hazard liquids to be operated by ECP braking systems.
Mr. Zupan, I'm going to need you to wrap it up here.
Okay. And then finally, regulations to require the screening of locomotive engineers for sleep apnea. So there's a broader context to this bill. And unfortunately, regardless of what the federal preemption may or may not be, it's important that the Minnesota legislature take a stand for railway safety and then make an argument to the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Last scheduled testifier is Claire Rubeck from the Citizens Acting for Rail Safety. And I'm sorry, I didn't check to see if there are any questions for Mr. Supan. All right, thank you.
Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Claire Rubeck, Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, and it's my honor today to represent people who live in rail communities and near the freight rails across the state of Minnesota, ranging from St. Cloud down to Red Wing, down to Reno and in Mankato, as well as the Twin Cities region. We're an all-volunteer advocacy group, and we have been in existence since the year following the incident in Lac Mégantic. I happen to live in the overlay of two evacuation zones, a BNSF line that hauls oil trains that have grown in length, and also the TC Twin Cities and Western, excuse me, I'm a little nervous, line that hauls ethanol trains. And so this is of great concern to me and other members in my community, and we do not see this as a collective bargaining labor issue. We are a stakeholder. The public safety is what we are asking you to defend. We don't have a voice at that collective bargaining negotiation, and so we need you to stand up for our interests in terms of this safety bill. Lac Mégantic was raised earlier, and I would like to mention that the initial report that was issued did indicate that crew size was a causation factor, and as the report went through various iterations where stakeholders were reviewing and collaborating with the final report, it was eventually reduced to a risk factor. There has not been a judiciary inquiry to that incident, and there needs to be one. I support this bill, as I mentioned, as a citizen of Minnesota, and Citizens Acting for Rail Safety does as well. Please carry it forward. It's important to your constituents. And I will close with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just calling attention to several letters in our packet that underscore the testifier's point. They are from the Minnesota Firefighters and the Minnesota State Patrol, both of whom give explanations for why, from the public safety perspective, they support the legislation. It sort of underscores the testifier's point.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Any further questions? All right, seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill that has not yet testified? All right, thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Chair? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we heard a lot of testimony on this bill this afternoon, but very little of it seems to indicate that increasing crew size actually leads to a reduction in accidents. When I look at the statistical evidence of our railroads' performance across the country, their safety record has been steadily improving. And I think that speaks for itself. There is a very complex issue of preemption here that I'm no lawyer. I'm not going to try and sort that out, nor do I think that we as the state legislature should try to sort it out. Do we as a legislature have a role in railroad safety? Certainly we do, but I don't think our role is best played by trying to impact this particular effort. I don't believe that we should be voting for this bill. I think what we should be concentrating on is doing our side of railroad safety, and that is making railroad crossings as safe as we can here in the state of Minnesota. We've done a lot of work along those lines over the years, and I think that's also reflected in the safety record that's been steadily improving regarding railroads and how they interact with the public here in Minnesota. Rail grade crossings, investing in those as we have done, especially recently, to reduce the number of intersections where trains and other vehicles actually interact is a big step in the right direction. Improving the signage at the railroad crossings in cooperation with the railroad is another step that's very important that helps keep our railroads safe. Public awareness of the risk of interaction between automobiles, trucks, and the railroads is also important, so continued public education, which the railroad also cooperates in, is also important. Bottom line is, you know, the railroads are federally regulated. We are not the federal government. We are state government. We have a role to play, but mandating two-man crews is not the role that we should play. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call on the vote.
Roll call has been requested. Did you have anything you'd like to say in response to that, Chair Hornstein?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and I want to thank all the testifiers from both sides.
Chair, sorry, we have another question on the list. I just didn't know. And Representative Joachim as well. Yep, I've got Representative Petersburg is next. Did you have anything you would like to say in response to Representative Torkelson?
Yeah, actually.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson, for that. You know, we had a pretty involved discussion about rail crossing several years ago, and I agree with you very much on your contention, Representative Torkelson. As I recall, it was the railroads that testified repeatedly that rail crossings weren't really an issue in terms of safety. So I wonder if we should kind of revive the idea that Governor Dayton had to have the railroads kick in for some rail safety, rail crossing improvements. I thought that was good policy then. I think it's good policy now.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to get back to really the issue at hand here, which is about the implied that one person or two person crews actually improve safety along the routes. And to what Chair Hornstein talked about, absolutely railroad crossings are there, but they're railroad crossings for the motor vehicles, which are really the cause of accidents. If you look at the accidents that are occurring, almost all of that has to do with the error of those motor vehicle drivers. So whether you have one or two people in the cab of the train, they're not going to avoid that. They have no way of veering away or stopping within the amount of time necessary. So the accidents are going to occur whether there's one person or two person crews. And the discussion about, well, the aftermath of the accident and the cleanup, one person or two person crews aren't going to help with that cleanup. They really are going to be dealing with only the safety during the use and control of the train itself. And so the idea that we're dealing with safety here to avoid accidents or to avoid deaths, and by the way, I want to be on record, I think one person dying is too much, but the reality is a car versus a train, the train always wins. And so we have to deal with that. But what we're really talking about here is if with two-member crews, two-person crews, that maybe they'd be able to help after the fact, but that doesn't help with the safety. And so the fact is that we're not going to help with actual safety on the trains. Train companies don't have an option on what they carry. So if there's hazardous material on it, they don't have a choice. And that's where we really need to start discussing really on safety. So one person, two person crews, it really boils down to, and I think it really is, an employee relations issue and not really about safety.
Mr. Chair, do you have anything you'd like to comment on that?
No.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just some comments, too. So I looked up the federal law, and I know we're not lawyers here, but we actually, part of our job is to play lawyers here and create law. So the law talks about federal preemption, and it's pretty explicit in that law that it's to the extent practical and that state law can be more stringent for safety if necessary or to eliminate or reduce essential local or safety hazards. We have a letter in our packet from the League of Minnesota Cities saying they have seen issues with this and seen those hazards. And I think about not just the hazards with the interaction of cars, which frequently happens at every crossing, but you think about what we do with airplanes. Airplanes are required to have two pilots. there's a reason. They don't have as many things to run into up there in the air as trains do down here. But a lot of that has to do for the safety of the people driving the trains, too, and the fatigue that happens. And I know collective bargaining was thrown out, which I am a huge proponent of collective bargaining. My husband's been a union negotiator for 16 years before he stepped down. So I get that. But we have our union folks here asking for this because they have been told no, no, and no time and time again. So we have an opportunity here to listen to the folks that are really doing the work, and this really affects. So I think I really hope you will consider that when you vote. Thank you.
Quickly, Mr. Representative Kosnick.
Yep, I appreciate the comments that we just heard, basically saying that this is a collective bargaining issue, and that's why it's brought before the legislature. So I think that appreciate the honesty in the comments.
That's okay. We can talk after.
All right, Mr. Chair, would you like to renew your motion and any closing comments?
Well, thank you very much. And just in closing, I did want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee, and really the quality testimony we had from both sides. This is an issue that, again, for me, I will reiterate, my initial comments and those of others, Ms. Rubeck and others, that it does come down for a practical matter of safety. I think just to have two people instead of one does increase safety, and that's my motivation for bringing this. And members, this legislation does have to go at least to another committee or two, and if there are other items that people want to bring to my attention, obviously we'll take those into consideration. So with that, members, I thank you, and I would renew my motion that House File 286 be referred to Ways and Means, knowing that it may go on to public safety from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a roll call has been requested on this item, so will the clerk please call the roll.
Hornstein?
Yes.
Tabke?
Yes.
Torkelson?
No.
Bernardi?
Yes.
Elkins?
Yes.
Hausman?
Yes.
Heinrich? Absent. Cagle?
Yes.
Kosnick?
No.
Mason?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Petersburg?
No.
Richardson? Absent. Runbeck?
No.
West? Absent. Wolgamott? Absent. Joachim?
Yes.
With 9 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You're moving on to Ways and Means. And one last item that we need to clear up. There were two changes from the minutes that we just need to re-approve here real quick. That were brought to our attention. First was that Chair Hornstein called the meeting to order at 12:45. A quorum was not yet present. We need to confirm that a quorum was present before we move to the bills. And then the second was in part one of the agenda, we need to strike the words not yet and strike all of part two above that. Is that correct that we need to do? Everyone follow where I was at with that? There are just two minor changes that need to be done, thanks to our stellar staff. So, all those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. And with that, we are in recess till the call of the chair this evening.
For one bill only.
For one bill only.
I'd like to reconvene, members. I'd like to reconvene the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division for this Thursday evening, March 7th. We just wanted to continue the bill that we started hearing in Blaine and then heard on Tuesday. Representative Kegel, I'm hoping that the third time is a charm for you. So
we all are.
I know that we had public testimony in Blaine. You had a DE1 amendment. We have some additional amendments to the DE1. If you could just very briefly refresh our memories about the highlights of House File 1408, and then we can get into the amendments that have been submitted by members. So if you want to proceed, Representative Cagle, again, our motion for this is to refer the bill to Ways and Means, where it will likely be referred to Public Safety after that. So Representative Cagle, thank you for hanging in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel like this bill, every time I keep thinking about Lord of the Rings with this bill, you shall not pass.
Representative Cagle, just before you start, I wanted to mention that the re-referral is for the House File 1408 as amended, because you have the DE1. So that's already been incorporated. Proceed.
So House File 1408 is just an effort to keep our workers safe on the roads. AGC and Safety Director from Iron Range testified last week on this bill. Construction work zones with active traffic present different challenges for the safety of road construction workers. And so our intent with this first provision of this bill is to do hands-free only cell phone in construction work zones. We want the public to know that when you see orange, put the phone down. We're hoping that we don't have, that eventually this will be able to be dropped if we can get the hands-free bill passed here in the legislature. And then the other provision is with flaggers. So flaggers are the people who control the traffic. And so we want to make sure that the men and women are safe who help keep the traffic flowing through road construction. And especially since flagging is a particularly dangerous job due to the proximity of the road. And so we've modeled that portion of the bill after the school bus stop arm law. So the bill would allow flaggers to call law enforcement if the driver violates their directives. If the worker can identify the license plate and car description, law enforcement could issue a citation if the driver is located within 4 hours. A school bus driver has this option if a driver violates the school bus stop arm. So that's just really the bill in a nutshell.
Okay. Members, as their discussion, or do you want to go straight? We have several amendments, and we could potentially go into it. Mr. Bruce, do you want to explain kind of we had an issue with the engrossment and the amendments? And
Mr. Chair, members, as you'll recall, the bill's been heard and amended a couple of times. The current state of the bill based on committee action is that the DE1 amendment was adopted and the A4 amendment was adopted, and those would be the two that represent the work of the committee at this point.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Burris. So then we have two amendments, I believe, an A6 and an A7. Who wants to claim these?
I do.
Okay. Representative Torkelson, to your amendment.
Thank you. And I'm not going to do the A5. Maybe I told you that.
Yeah.
Already. Okay. Good.
Good.
We'll start with the A6. I would like to move the A6 amendment.
So move.
The A6 deals with sign placement, and I've received information that perhaps the department would like to testify to this amendment, because there may already be language in place, but I would like to talk a little bit about the issue, because I've noted in my own driving at times you come upon signs along the road that indicate there may be a flagger ahead or that there's construction happening, and you get to the actual construction zone and there is no flagger and there is nothing going on, and in fact the cones have been set off to the side of the road to, and the problem with that is it's a bit like the boy crying wolf, that driver sees that and they go, well, there's nothing here. And then the next time they come upon a similar situation, they may think, well, it's the same deal. I'm just going to drive through because there's nothing going on. And that time maybe there is activity. So this would encourage the signs to come down just as quickly as possible once the work is done, and I think I saw a nod from the department that they wanted to talk about this, so I'd be happy to call them down at this time.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening. Thank you. My name is Tom Raven. I'm the Director of the Office of Construction Innovative Contracting for MnDOT. So Yes, so as far as the A6 amendment, we don't like when contractors leave signs up either. There should be road work ahead signs up there, but if they have flagger ahead signs and there's not a flagger, we don't want to be telling the public that, and we don't want, because we want them to obey our signs. So if they're leaving those signs up there, that's the last thing we want them to do. It's actually covered in the Minnesota Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices that they need to remove those temporary signs when they're done with the construction. So I think it's covered already. We can certainly provide you with a copy of that manual. You can take a look at it and see what you think.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Just as a point of information, something I didn't realize that I've learned in the last few days of talking about issues like this is that in many cases on construction projects, the signing and flagging is done by a third party, so to speak. Independent company is contracted to come in and do that part of the project, supplying the signs and the flaggers. Is that common?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Raven.
Representative Torkelson, it's typically a subcontractor that's done. Some of the prime contractors do have their own traffic control folks, but most of them use a subcontractor. There's probably three or four of them that get the most use in Minnesota.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in that case, who's responsible if signs don't come down? Who would the department chastise?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, whoever's there at the time, you know, depending on ultimately the prime contractor is responsible, but we would probably go, sometimes they're setting it up for whoever the operation, they're setting the traffic control up. Sometimes they'll set the traffic control up and leave, go somewhere else to another part of the state, and they may be late in getting back to the project. You know, typically those lane closures can't be up during peak hours, so they would be up between like 9 and 3, and we have major penalties if they're up during rush hour. So we would pass that through the prime contractor to the, I'm sure they'd pass it down to the subcontractor over the traffic control contractor, whoever would be responsible.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the information from the department, I'll withdraw the A6 amendment.
Okay. Mr. Petersburg?
Oh, I'm sorry.
If he's withdrawing at that time.
Okay. The A6 is withdrawn. So we have an A7 as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to offer the A7 amendment.
Representative Torkelson, proceed.
I've learned also that there is a flagger instruction book that the department has published and utilizes to help train flaggers. This would be an addition to that that would kind of reflect the work of this bill and incorporate it into the flagger book so that we know that flaggers are being informed if this bill moves forward, that they're being properly trained and informed of these additional duties.
Comments from either Mr. Raven or the author?
Mr. Chair, representatives, we would not have any objection to that. We do have a flagger certification training program, so we actually, in our work zone safety unit, we have a train the trainer. We will train trainers to go out and train flaggers around the state, and actually the flaggers are required to carry a card with them, so we'll ask them. The card looks like this. This is a card. It has a particular person on it saying they've been through the class, so we don't have any objection to that.
President Torkelson?
I think we could proceed to a vote on the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Any comments from the author?
I would accept that as a friendly amendment.
Oh, you got one.
Representative Heinrich, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a quick question for the witness. I don't know if now is the right time.
Absolutely,
yeah. Answer to this.
No, totally appropriate to ask now.
Sir, would it be correct to say that flaggers are, I work in the asphalt industry, and in my experience, I might be wrong, but it seems that the flaggers a lot of time are the lowest on the totem pole, so to speak, of that crew. Is that generally an entry-level position? I don't mean to use lowest on the totem pole, but you know, you're certainly not operating a piece of equipment when you're a flagger. Is that a more of an entry-level position onto a work crew?
Mr. Raven.
Representative, first of all, you know, we don't hire the flag folks. I mean, that's the contractors that hire them. But typically, we can tell if someone has been trained in flagging fairly quickly, and we will have that person removed or ask if they've been through the training. And I'll just ad lib a little bit here. I mean, flagging should not be our first option, because you're putting people in harm's way. And I've been around the department for 34 years. We've had 2 fatalities on projects that I'm aware of in the metro in that time. It's a horrible thing. So if we can find some way to prevent having put flaggers out there, so I look at it like guardrail. Guardrail is a hazard. If we can design the road so we don't have a drop-off, we don't have a tight curve or whatever, we would do that. And same with flaggers. If we can design our work zone so we don't have to have flaggers, we'd rather not do that.
I appreciate that. That's good, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that.
Great. Any further discussion to the bill as amended? Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. This is the A7. Any further discussion to the A7 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, the motion prevails. The A7 is adopted. And now, is there any further discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Heinrich, and then Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cagle, I brought this concern up before, but I just wanted to do it here in the basement as well. And again, I really appreciate the intention here. Again, my concern revolves around the extra responsibilities that flaggers will have, given that, in fact, in my professional experience, they are a lower-ranking member of the crew a lot of the time. It is more of an entry-level position. That combined with the discretion of the flagger of whether or not somebody has committed a violation to the point where now they need to possibly redirect their attention to taking down, year, make, model of a car, license plate information, and possibly not having their head on a swivel, to use a military term, and making sure that they're paying attention to pedestrians, other vehicles, making sure their safety is a priority as well. So those are. I just wanted to kind of explain a couple of my concerns. Again, I know I already did that and asked the witness that we had in Blaine, I believe, about some of those things. But those are my concerns. I can't vote for this bill because that, as it sits right now, I think that there might be other approaches to increase work site safety. But again, being in that industry and dealing with heavy traffic at times, I completely understand the intent there. Another quick thing that I have is that the officer that's going to issue the citation doesn't have to witness the violation, and so I just I don't feel right about that. So with that, again, thank you, Representative. I appreciate the intent here. I think all of us here do want to protect, and I just don't feel like this bill maybe could have some unintended consequences. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concerns are along the same line. It just seems like there's a bit of kind of word of mouth, some fuzziness about what these instructions are. I mean, will there be signs that the flagger holds to say do this or do that? Or it just seems like it has some vagueness to it, which could be a problem if somebody gets a ticket and decides to challenge it.
Thank you for that. Is there any other discussion? Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bill has gotten better as we've been working through the process, and I appreciate the author's openness to making it better. I will not be voting for the bill this evening, but I know this is a real issue that deserves attention, and I encourage the author to continue working on the issue as it moves through the process, and we'll see where it ends up. But I will be voting no this evening. I have some real questions about just how this might work and what we expect flaggers to be able to do in a very busy environment.
Well, thank you, Representative Torkelson. I appreciate your involvement in this and your amendments and attempts to improve it. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To me,
the flaggers are in a very vulnerable position, and we know that there have been deaths. We also know that people are going through red lights. Getting people to obey laws is getting to be a very major issue. So I guess I will be voting for this because I know that the testifier said that this is their last option when they do have the construction. But nevertheless, we have to do something. I mean, we just can't allow people to keep ignoring the construction sites. And I'm thinking this is the best we can do right now.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Any other questions or further discussion?
Well, Mr.
Representative Tapke?
Mr. Raven wanted to say a few
okay.
words as well.
We'll have Representative Tapke make a comment. We can have Mr. Raven, then we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you.
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention the fact with some of the pushback on the bill is that there's already some precedent with school buses being able to, bus drivers being able to share the things that have not been going well. I'm not able to do two things at once, evidently.
Sorry. I know how I feel.
You're much better at it than I am. So just making sure that we understand that there is precedent with bus drivers on this, and I'm going to stand up now.
I'm calling on Clara. Clearly, Clara has some comments. Okay. All right. Okay. Mr. Raven, did you want to weigh in here before we vote?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We support this bill. We do have some concerns with one of the amendments that was added this last week regarding a pay item for flaggers that was included. It may seem, you know, kind of counterintuitive, but the main concern is that the language is very broad, and we typically pay for our traffic control on our project flaggers through a lump sum traffic control. I understand the concern of the contractors. They're concerned that they want a level playing field. We require them to assess when they're bidding a project how many flaggers they'll need. And we enforce that when we get on the project. For instance, if you're doing a mill and overlay on a two-lane road and you've got a flagger operation, you've got to have a flagger at every major intersection to make sure traffic can get through there. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's hard to get flaggers. They don't always put the money in their bid so they can have a flagger everywhere we need them. So I think that is kind of driving this bill. They're asking us to provide a pay item for that. We're willing to do that on certain projects, but this bill is written far too broad to the point where it would require us almost to have a pay item in every project. And we really need to have contractors. Every contractor does things a little different. They have different means and methods, different ways they do things. We don't always know how they're going to build a project when they're bidding it. We can't anticipate how they're going to do that. So it's hard for us to anticipate and put a legitimate number of hours in the plan before they bid it. So we would hope that we could work with MAPA on this and work with them to work this out so we don't have to have a pay item on every project.
Thank you, Mr. Raven. Representative Cagle, you get the last word here before we vote.
It's late. I want to thank everybody on the committee for sharing baby duty. And want to thank you guys all for coming back this evening to get this bill moved. I think it's really important for the safety of our men and women working on the roads. I shared that my grandfather was a flagger. And so I really hope that we can get this, and I will continue to work on it. So thank you.
Thanks, and I did just want to share with the committee, I did get a text from Russ Hess from the Laborers Union who wanted me to share with the committee that they're in support of the bill. There's no further discussion. Then we'll take a vote on House File 1408 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and you're on your way to Ways and Means and then probably Public Safety from there. I also want to add a word of thanks to the committee for coming back, and thanks for a really a good discussion on our earlier bills today. We will not be hearing, of course, the other bills that were on the agenda today. We're not hearing them tonight, so we're done. And then, of course, for those of you, I know we have lots of competition tomorrow, but for those of you who are going to take the bus tomorrow, we'll be
meeting outside of the state office building at the front steps at between 8:45 and 9 o'clock. We'll be boarding. 9:05 we'll leave.
And then we'll be in Mankato from noon to 3 tomorrow. If you have any questions about any of these logistics, please get in touch with Mr. Howe. What's for lunch? We're going to be relying on Representative Petersburg, Representative Torkelson to tell us the good places to go. And
you know I'm not going to be
in Mankato.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and then members, we're working through a lot of bills that are before the committee that are policy-oriented, and we'll do that next week. At this point, I think you should plan on evening meetings Tuesday and Thursday, and hopefully we can get done Thursday before the deadline. If not, we would potentially have a meeting on Friday, but we'll have a better sense on Tuesday of how we're progressing. But I will say no field hearings next week. I don't anticipate any additional ones this session, although we may meet later in April over at the Union Depot, but that's not very far away. So with that, if there's no further questions, yes, Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking forward to, like, next week, as you mentioned, we don't have an agenda of which bills we'll be hearing on Tuesday.
That will be generated tomorrow by Mr. Howe.
Okay, appreciate it.
So we're still.
You know why I'm asking.
Yes, yeah. Okay. And I've been in touch with Mr. Shetton, and I think we're coming up with a plan to make sure that Metro Mobility gets to Lakeville.
Excellent.
That you will be a part of.
Thank you.
So, is there any further discussion? If not, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much again for coming this extra hour, members.